November 15th, 1928, Grand Canyon National Park, Arizona. 29-year-old Glenn Hyde and his 22-year-old wife Bessie decide to spend their honeymoon taking a rafting trip down the rapids of the Colorado River. Shortly after stopping at the home of a photographer named Emery Kolb, the Hydes vanish without a trace, and their empty boat is discovered in the river over 1 month later. Over the next several decades, there would be a number of twists, including a woman who claimed to be Bessie Hyde, and the discovery of an unidentified male skeleton in Emery Kolb's boathouse. But no trace of Glenn or Bessie is ever found. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be traveling back 90 years to cover a mystery which took place in the Grand Canyon, the 1928 disappearances of Glenn and Bessie Hyde. That voice you just heard narrate our opening was Colin Zavitz, the latest winner of our Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, and he did a tremendous job, so thank you very much, Colin. Anyway, if you're an Unsolved Mysteries fan, you're probably familiar with this story, as it was featured on the very first episode of the show hosted by Robert Stack. Last month, I recorded an audio commentary track over that episode as a bonus reward on Patreon for our Tier 3 patrons, and as I was doing it, my first thought was, why haven't I done a podcast episode about this story yet? Glenn and Bessie Hyde were a newlywed couple who decided to take a very adventurous honeymoon by embarking on a lengthy whitewater rafting trip through the Grand Canyon along the Colorado River, and they hoped to find fame by achieving a new speed record. But they would eventually go missing, and even though the couple's empty boat was found completely intact, with all their supplies still on board, Glenn and Bessie had seemingly vanished into thin air. This story has become a pretty legendary unsolved disappearance with a number of twists and turns, and even contains a compelling mystery within a mystery, as a skeleton initially believed to be Glenn Hyde would be found on the property of one of the last people known to have seen the couple alive. We just passed the 90th anniversary of the Hyde's disappearance this past November, so I definitely think this is a good time to tackle the very first Mysterious Legends case featured on Unsolved Mysteries. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the mysterious disappearance of Glenn and Bessie Hyde. Our story begins in Arizona in 1928. Our central figures are a newlywed couple from Twin Falls, Idaho, 29-year-old Glenn Hyde and his 22-year-old wife, Bessie Hyde. Glenn makes his living as a farmer, and the circumstances of how he got married to Bessie are pretty unusual. Ironically enough, given what eventually happened to them, the couple first met on a passenger ship traveling from San Francisco to Los Angeles in February of 1927, and they pretty much fell head over heels in love with each other. The problem was that Bessie was technically still married to another man in another state at that point. Originally born in Maryland, and raised in Parkersburg, West Virginia as Bessie Haley, Bessie was attending Marshall College when she married Earl Helmick in Kentucky in June of 1926. Even though Bessie and Earl had known each other for years and attended high school together, their relationship was pretty much doomed from the start, as Earl was known for having a violent temper. The couple lived together for less than 2 months before they separated, and Bessie moved to San Francisco to study art and poetry at the California School of Fine Arts. It's been reported that while she was living there, Earl sent Bessie money for a quote-unquote operation, fueling speculation that she had traveled out west to terminate an unwanted pregnancy or to secretly give birth to a child to put up for adoption, but this has never officially been confirmed. Whatever the case, Bessie would meet Glenn several months later and wanted to marry him as soon as possible, but Earl refused to grant her a divorce. In response, Bessie decided to move to Elko, Nevada, since the state had the most lenient divorce laws in the country at that time, and she lived there for a couple months to meet residency requirements. After Bessie filed for divorce, it would officially be granted on April 11, 1928, when Earl failed to show up in court to contest it. Bessie then immediately traveled to Twin Falls to meet up with Glenn, and they were married the following day. Anyway, since Glenn was an avid outdoorsman and an experienced rafter who had run the Salmon and Snake Rivers in Idaho, he came up with a very unusual idea for a delayed honeymoon. Glenn constructed a 2-ton, 20-foot-long, 5.5-foot-wide, flat-bottomed wooden sweep scow, which he named Rain in the Face, and decided that he and Bessie would spend their honeymoon taking a lengthy whitewater rafting trip through the Grand Canyon. They would travel to Green River, Utah, and spend the next several weeks in their scow, traveling hundreds of miles down the rapids of the Colorado River before they arrived in Needles, California. The Colorado River was considered to be the most dangerous stretch of water in the world at that point, and only 45 people had managed to travel the full 277-mile length of the Grand Canyon by river. But Glenn was an adventurous thrill-seeker who wanted to set a brand new all-time speed record. By taking Bessie along, she would make history by becoming the first documented woman to run the canyon. If they succeeded, the couple would likely become famous, and Glenn hoped that Bessie would use her writing skills to publish a book, and they could make money recounting their adventure by touring the lecture circuit. Well, in spite of Glenn's vast river rafting experience, Bessie was pretty much a complete novice at this sort of thing. Glenn also made the decision not to carry any life jackets on board the boat, as apparently, using life jackets was just not something that was done in Idaho during that time period, and they were not even readily available. The Hydes began their trip in Green River on October 20th, and legend has it that an experienced river rafter who saw Glenn's scow described it as a quote-unquote wooden coffin and expressed his belief that it was not safe enough for this sort of trip. Regardless, the Hydes managed to complete the first leg of their journey and made it to Grand Canyon National Park in record time. The 277-mile trip through the canyon on the Colorado River could easily be documented by the mile markers which were placed at various locations, and on November 15th, the couple arrived at the Phantom Ranch near River Mile 88. They then proceeded to hike up Bright Angel Trail until they arrived at the home of a photographer named Emery Kolb. Emery and his brother Ellsworth had become legendary figures in the Grand Canyon by successfully navigating the Colorado River and filming the entire experience. Emery's home also doubled as a photography studio named Kolb Studio, which had been in business for nearly 25 years at this point. Glenn knew that Kolb was pretty much the area's foremost expert on the Colorado River, which is why he and Bessie paid him a visit. While there, the Hydes asked Kolb to take a photograph of them posing by the canyon's south rim. However, during their interactions, Kolb noticed that Bessie seemed to have grown tired of the trip and appeared apprehensive because they were about to embark on the most dangerous stretch of the river. Earlier on their journey, while traveling through the rapids of Cataract Canyon, Bessie, who was only 5 feet tall and weighed 90 pounds, was knocked into the river, but Glenn managed to grab her ankle and pull her back into the boat. Glenn had also apparently fallen out of the scow on 2 separate occasions before Bessie managed to get a rope to him. Since the Hydes were going to be facing cold winter weather, Kolb proposed the idea of them staying with him for a while, at least until the weather improved, but Glenn refused. Kolb also offered to let the Hydes borrow his life jackets or some inner tubes, but Glenn turned that down as well, referring to the items as quote-unquote artificial aids, and assuring Cold that he and Bessie were both very strong swimmers. Before the Hydes left, Cold's young daughter appeared to say goodbye to them. Bessie looked at the shoes the girl was wearing and said, quote, "I wonder if I shall ever wear pretty shoes again." The Hydes then hiked back down Bright Angel Trail, climbed back into their boat, and continued their trip down the river. The following day, the Hydes stopped at a tourist facility and bumped into a tourist named Adolf Gilbert Sutro, whose grandfather had been mayor of San Francisco during the late 19th century. In exchange for some supplies, the Hydes agreed to allow Sutro to hitch a ride on their boat with them for the next couple of miles while they traveled downstream to Hermit Camp. Sutro took one final photograph of Glenn and Bessie before they went their separate ways, but after this, there would be no more confirmed sightings of the Hydes. They failed to arrive in Needles, California at their scheduled time, and when Glenn's father, R.C. Hyde, did not hear from them by December 6th, he organized a search effort involving the National Park Service and several volunteers. R.C. had previously lost two sons when they were children, and was so dedicated to finding Glenn that he pretty much drove himself into poverty by financing multiple searches for him over the next several years. At one point during their journey, the Hydes had crossed paths with a reporter for the Denver Post and shared their story, which soon garnered some coverage in the press. So by the time the couple went missing, the search for them had become national news. In fact, the story got so much attention that it even wound up reaching President Calvin Coolidge, who ordered his Secretary of War to authorize an air search of Grand Canyon National Park with an army plane. Well, on December 19th, the plane finally spotted the Hyde scow, which appeared to be trapped in some rocks in the middle of the water near River Mile 237. Even though the boat seemed to be intact, Glenn and Bessie were not inside. It would not be until Christmas Day when a search party, which included Emery and Ellsworth Kolb, made it to this location and located the scow. Much like when it was spotted from the search plane, the boat was fully intact with no noticeable signs of damage, and it was fully stocked with supplies and the Hydes' personal possessions, including their clothing and hiking boots, Glenn's rifle, and a diary Bessie had been using to chronicle their journey. The only thing which appeared to be missing was the Hydes themselves. 42 notches were found carved in the boat's gunwale, which seemed to represent each day of the trip. If the count was accurate, then this meant the last notch had been carved on November 30th, which coincided with the date of the final entry in Bessie's diary. The scow's bow line stretched from the front of the boat into the river and appeared to be fastened in a crevice in one of the rocks and caught on something underwater. Since the Cole brothers had no success with their attempts to dislodge the bow line, they decided to cut the rope. In spite of this discovery, subsequent search efforts failed to turn up any trace of Glenn or Bessie. The last specific location Bessie had mentioned in her diary was Diamond Creek Rapid, located at River Mile 225, and evidence was discovered to suggest the Hydes had set up camp in the area. In fact, 2 years later, a search party for an unrelated event wound up finding an inscription on the beam of a ceiling in an old shack near Diamond Creek. It read, "Glenn and Bessie Hyde, November 31st, 1928. If either Glenn or Bessie had inscribed that, they probably did so on December 1st of that year and had forgotten that November only had 30 days. There was also an eyewitness account from a prospector who reportedly saw a brown leather jacket floating in the Colorado River around the approximate time the Hydes went missing. The currents were too swift for him to retrieve it, but Bessie was known to have worn a leather jacket on the trip. Ironically, the location the boat was found was just over 40 miles from the mouth of the Grand Canyon, and if the details in Bessie's diary were accurate, the couple had actually been ahead of schedule and would have easily broken the speed record if they had traveled the entire distance. Anyway, even though the Hydes' bodies could not be found, many people suspected that Glenn and Bessie had fallen out of their scow and drowned in the river. Others theorized that they may have become separated from the boat and attempted to hike their way out of the canyon, but died of exposure before they made it. However, over the course of the next several decades, a number of unusual events would occur, which caused speculation that there was a lot more to this story. In 1971, a tour group went on a 3-week commercial rafting trip through the Grand Canyon, and near the end of their trip, they set up camp at Diamond Creek. Because this was near the location where Glenn and Bessie Hyde's boat had been found over 4 decades earlier, the tour guide decided to share the story about their mysterious disappearance around the campfire that night. It was here that an elderly woman in the group named Elizabeth Cutler remarked that she was actually Bessie Hyde. She claimed that Glenn had become so obsessed with completing the rafting trip that things erupted into a violent fight, which resulted in Glenn beating her. In response, she grabbed a knife, stabbed Glenn to death, sank his body, and let their boat float downstream. She then proceeded to hike her own way out of the Grand Canyon to Peach Springs, climbed on a bus, and then went on to start a new life for herself under her new identity. While the other members of the group initially figured Cutler was just making up the story, even though she would have been around the same age as Bessie if she was still alive at that time. But word about this story eventually spread, and when historians tracked down Cutler to her home in Pomeroy, Ohio, and asked her about it, she denied ever telling the story and claimed to have never heard of Glenn or Bessie Hyde. Once further research was done, it became clear that Cutler's story could not have been true. Not only was she around half a foot taller than Bessie Hyde, but birth records showed that Cutler was born in Pomeroy on December 2nd, 1908. In fact, old newspaper articles were uncovered, which showed photographs of Cutler attending some family reunions in Pomeroy during the late 1920s, effectively debunking the idea that she was Bessie Hyde living under a false identity. Cutler died in 1998, and since she had once worked as a psychology professor and had a reputation for playing mind games with people, this may have been the reason she had decided to tell people she was Bessie. The next surprise development took place when Emery Cole passed away on December 11, 1976, at the age of 96. 2 months later, Kolb's grandson was going through the boathouse on his property at Kolb's studio when he was surprised to discover the remains of a male skeleton inside a canoe being kept in the rafters. Some remnants of clothing, a shoe, and a belt were next to the remains, and everything was subsequently turned over to the Coconino County Medical Examiner's Office. The victim was determined to have been a Caucasian male in his 20s, but most importantly, a bullet from a .32 caliber gun was found embedded in his skull, and there was a bullet hole in his right temple. Tests showed that the bullet originated from a revolver originally manufactured in 1902, and the condition of the bones and the clothing fragments seemed to suggest that the victim's death had occurred sometime during the 1920s. Of course, this began to fuel rumors that the victim was Glenn Hyde and that Emery Kolb could have murdered him. Well, like I mentioned in the intro, this case would be featured on the very first episode of Unsolved Mysteries hosted by Robert Stack, which originally aired on November 29, 1987. For the segment, they consulted with Dr. Walter Berkby, a forensic anthropologist from the University of Arizona. Well, Berkby was a nationally recognized expert in this field and had earned the nickname Dr. Death because he specialized in unidentified human remains. Basically, long before the era of DNA testing and the Doe Network, Dr. Berkby was one of the best people to turn to if you ever wanted to identify the skeletal remains of a John or Jane Doe. So naturally, the skeleton found in Kolb's boathouse was passed on to him. The segment showed Berkby performing a test where he compared the facial structure of the skull to a photograph of Glenn Hyde and determined they did not match at all. While Berkby was unable to determine the victim's true identity, he was able to conclude with 100% certainty that it was not Glenn. Of course, this only opened up a lot more unanswered questions, creating a mystery within a mystery about who the remains actually did belong to and why Kolb had been keeping them on his property. Well, believe it or not, it wasn't long before rumors started to spread about another woman possibly being Bessie Hyde under a new identity. In May of 1992, Georgie White Clark, a legendary figure in the field of river rafting, died of cancer at the age of 81. Georgie had worked as a river running guide in the Grand Canyon for 45 years and made history in 1952 when she became the first woman to row the full length of the Grand Canyon and Arizona's Marble Canyon. Following her death, Georgie's caretaker was searching through her lingerie drawer and was surprised to discover a certified copy of Glenn and Bessie Hyde's marriage certificate, which also happened to be resting alongside a pistol. Furthermore, when Georgie's birth certificate was uncovered, it revealed that she had originally been born under the name Bessie DeRoss, as White and Clark were the surnames of the two ex-husbands she had previously been married to. Throughout her life, Georgie was always known for being a very secretive woman, even to her closest friends. Georgie's caretaker also recalled her expressing a personal hatred towards Emery Kolb and refusing to even be in the same room with him, though she never specified why. So naturally, this only fueled speculation that Georgie White Clark was actually Bessie Hyde. However, since Georgie was about 5 inches taller than Bessie and didn't really resemble her that much, it didn't take long for historians to debunk this idea, particularly since Georgie's early life was well documented in a biography titled Woman of the River. Georgie married her first husband at an early age and was only 17 years old when she gave birth to a daughter in March of 1929. So if Georgie was Bessie Hyde, then that meant Bessie would have had to be 5 months pregnant at the time she vanished, so the idea of them being the same person was pretty much completely dismissed. In 2001, two separate books about the disappearance of Glenn and Bessie Hyde were released pretty much simultaneously. Interestingly enough, one of them was factual, and the other fictionalized, and apparently, neither of the authors even knew that the other book was being published. The factual book was Sunk Without a Sound, The Tragic Colorado River Honeymoon of Glenn and Bessie Hyde, which was written by a Grand Canyon River guide named Brad Dimmick, and is the most complete and detailed account of the story. As part of his research, Dimmick even went so far as to build an exact replica of the Hydes' wooden sweep scow and used it to travel down the Colorado River in order to get an exact idea of what the couple went through. The other book was titled Grand Ambition, and while author Lisa Michaels based the story on actual events, it was written in the style of a fictional novel, with Glenn and Bessie as the main characters. Anyway, in 2008, there would finally be some answers about the male skeleton found in Emery Kolb's boathouse. The cold case squad at the Coconino County Sheriff's Office were able to determine that the victim was likely an unidentified John Doe who had been found in the Grand Canyon at Shoshone Point in June of 1933. This discovery came about when the son of a former Grand Canyon ranger sent a number of photographs and documents from his father's collection to the Grand Canyon Museum collection. One of these photos featured the skeletal remains of the aforementioned John Doe when he was originally found. The victim carried no identification, and it was estimated that his actual death occurred about 2 years beforehand. He had a bullet hole in his right temple, and since a .32 caliber gun was next to the remains, his death was ruled to be a suicide. Clothing fragments, a shoe, and a belt were also found at the scene, and perfectly matched the same items found with Emery Kolb's skeleton. It turned out that in 1933, Kolb had been a representative on the county coroner's jury for death inquests at the Grand Canyon. Since the John Doe could not be identified, and there was no next of kin to claim his remains, it seemed likely that Kolb took them home himself and stored them in his boathouse. In fact, Kolb's grandson, who eventually found the remains 4 decades later, would recall having seen some bones on his grandfather's property when he was just a small boy during the 1930s. The actual identity of the John Doe is still unknown, but authorities are certain that no foul play was involved in his death, and that he has no connection to the Hyde case. As for Glenn and Bessie, the legend of their disappearance continues to live on after nearly a century, but the truth about what actually happened to them remains an unsolved mystery. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Man, I couldn't tell you how many times I watched the Unsolved Mystery segment about this story when I was a kid, as I once taped this particular episode off of TV and pretty much wore the VHS tape out. It may not be the first Unsolved Mysteries episode ever produced, as there were 3 others made before it hosted by either Raymond Burr or Carl Malden, but if you decide to watch this series on either Amazon Prime or YouTube, this will be the first episode in your queue. 2 other cases from this episode, the death of Aileen Conway and the disappearance of Dottie Kaler, have been featured on The Trail Went Cold, and the 4th segment covered the murder of Shannon Moore by her husband, Dave Davis. It remains one of the show's all-time greatest episodes, as each of their respective stories involved a husband and wife becoming caught up in a mystery. Of course, while there was hope that exposure on national television might help law enforcement solve the other three cases featured on the show, the Glenn and Bessie Hyde disappearance was nearly 60 years old by that point, so the segment was pretty much just there for entertainment. It is a very well done segment, and does not skimp on the production values for the reenactments, as you get to see unedited shots of the actors portraying Glenn and Bessie going down the dangerous rapids of the Colorado River in a wooden scow, much like the real people did back in 1928. I used to find it incredibly creepy that this couple could completely vanish without a trace, while all their supplies and personal belongings were found inside this completely empty, undamaged boat. All that being said, however, after doing further research into this story, and checking out Brad Dimmick's book, Sunk Without a Sound, it becomes apparent that Unsolved Mysteries greatly exaggerated some of the more mysterious aspects of the story, such as the discovery of the skeleton in Emery Kolb's boathouse, and Elizabeth Cutler's so-called confession that she was Bessie Hyde. Since the segment puts a lot of emphasis on Cutler's confession, it's easy to come away thinking that Glenn Hyde was some sort of abusive brute who dragged his naive, innocent, newlywed wife on a dangerous trip against her will, with no regard for her personal safety. And for whatever reason, the segment also gets Bessie's age wrong, claiming that she was only 18 years old when she was actually 22. They make no mention of the fact that Bessie had already been married and divorced by that point, which was not very common for a young woman during the 1920s, so she was a lot more worldly and independent than the segment portrayed her, and pretty much ahead of her time. In fact, Betsy's brother was once quoted as saying, "She should have been born a man," and he meant it as a compliment. When Brad Dimmick researched his book, everything he turned up about Glenn Hyde suggested he was a gentleman, and there was no indication that he ever abused his wife. At the outset, at least, it seems like Bessie was just as enthusiastic about this lengthy rafting trip as Glenn was. You could definitely question Glenn's judgment about a lot of things, particularly his refusal to bring along life jackets, but it sounds like he and Bessie genuinely loved each other. Now, to fully understand Glenn's reasoning for this trip, you have to remember that adventurers were very popular during this time period. It was only 1 year beforehand when Charles Lindbergh took the world's first solo non-stop transatlantic flight from New York to Paris in his plane, the Spirit of St. Louis, which made him one of the most famous celebrities in the world. So you can see why Glenn would be tempted to achieve his own fame and fortune by setting a new speed record for river rafting through the Grand Canyon, and I'm sure he loved the idea of putting his wife in the history books by making her the very first woman to accomplish this feat. And they almost pulled it off, because when you track the Hydes' known movements and see the location where their empty boat was found, they were only about 40 to 50 miles from their destination, and on pace to break the speed record before they vanished. So you can see why there has always been a major fascination with this story, even though, in the grand scheme of things, it's not hard to come up with a logical theory about what likely happened to Glenn and Bessie. Of course, another compelling aspect to this mystery was the discovery of the skeleton in Emery Kolb's boathouse nearly 50 years after the Hydes went missing, which helped bring their disappearance back into the spotlight. If this situation happened today, it would be very easy to answer the question of whether or not the victim was Glenn Hyde, as all it would require is getting DNA from Glenn's surviving relatives and comparing it with DNA from the remains. So it is quite amusing to watch the Unsolved Mystery segment and see how they handled this in the pre-DNA world of 1987, as Dr. Walter Berkby uses the rather primitive method of superimposing a photograph of Glenn over the victim's skull in order to conclude they do not match. Since a bullet was found in the skull, I can see why people would instantly jump on the theory that Emery Kolb murdered Glenn, particularly since Bessie had allegedly expressed concern to him about completing the rafting trip, so this would have been the perfect opportunity for Kolb to, quote-unquote, rescue her. But Dr. Berkby pretty much shoots that theory down during his interview and makes a valid point. If Kolb committed murder, why would he have kept the damn body around? The way the Unsolved Mystery segment framed things, you get the impression that the Hydes vanished immediately after visiting Kolb's place. They make no mention of their subsequent meetup with Adolph Gilbert Sutro, or the abundance of evidence, such as Bessie's diary entries, which showed that the couple were still alive for at least the next 2 weeks. I guess this was done in order to build up suspense over the idea that Cole murdered Glenn, but once you know all the full facts, you realize just how absurd this idea really is. In order for Kolb to have been the killer, he would need to travel around 140 miles to track Glenn down, and instead of disposing of him in the water or somewhere in the wilderness, he inexplicably decides to lug Glenn's body all the way back to his property and store it in his boathouse. But even after it was conclusively determined that the victim was not Glenn, there was still a big mystery for a while about who this man really was and why Kolb had his remains. It's actually pretty remarkable that they were able to at least partially solve this mystery 75 years after the fact, when they uncovered the photograph of the skeletal remains of the suicide victim found in Grand Canyon National Park in 1933 and matched it to the remains from Kolb's boathouse. Once it became apparent that Kolb served on the county coroner's jury at that time, this became less a case of deranged murderer keeps his victim's remains on his property than well-meaning citizen keeps an unidentified decedent's remains on his property and forgets about them for 4 decades. It's very likely that Kolb decided to take the John Doe's remains home with him, which might seem weird, but I can understand his reasoning. Since the victim could not be identified, he likely would have been buried in a pauper's grave somewhere and been difficult to find, so I think Kolb wanted to hold on to the remains on the off chance that the victim's loved ones might come around the area looking for him someday. Sadly, that never happened, and we may never find out the true identity of this John Doe, but the evidence clearly showed that there was no foul play involved in his death, and due to Emery Kolb's connection to the Hyde's disappearance, the situation pretty much blew up into a major misunderstanding. Of course, the Unsolved Mystery segment also put heavy emphasis on the possibility that Bessie Hyde could have murdered her husband, hiked out of the canyon, and traveled somewhere to start a new life under a new identity. This idea came about because of the story shared by Elizabeth Cutler during a commercial rafting trip in 1971, where she told everyone else sitting around the campfire that she was Bessie Hyde and revealed the full truth about what happened. The way the segment frames it is that Cutler was dead serious when she told this story and became incredibly defensive when people tried to question her about it later, denying that she ever told the story or even knew who Glenn and Bessie Hyde were. Well, when Brad Dimmick did further research into this angle and Sunk Without a Sound, he concluded that the details about Cutler's alleged confession seemed to have been greatly exaggerated. By the sound of things, since she had worked for many years in the field of psychology, Cutler had a tendency for saying outrageous things just to see people's reactions. Since this rafting group was camped near the spot where the Hydes' boat was found, and the guide decided to share the story about their disappearances, Cutler probably thought this would be a fun opportunity to troll people and claim she was Bessie Hyde. One of the members of this group was interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries, and he claimed that Cutler was a very serious and quiet person throughout the trip, which is why her story about being Bessie came across as believable. However, when some of the other group members were interviewed for Sunk Without a Sound, they described Cutler as a witty, cheerful character who loved to tease everyone, so they just felt she was joking when she told them she was Bessie. I think it's likely that when the legend of her story grew and eventually got blown out of proportion, Cutler tried to deny ever telling it, because technically, she did confess to committing a murder, which, joking or not, could have landed her in some hot water. But whatever her motivations were, there is concrete evidence that Elizabeth Cutler was born in Pomeroy, Ohio, and was living under that identity in 1928 when Bessie went missing, so there's no way they could possibly be the same person. And then there was the theory that Georgie White Clark might have been Bessie Hyde, an idea which spread when a copy of the Hydes' marriage certificate was found in her possessions after she died, along with a birth certificate which showed that Georgie's original birth name was Bessie. It is odd that Georgie would have a copy of that marriage certificate, but when you consider that her life revolved around river rafting through the Grand Canyon, you'd have to think that she was familiar with the story of the Hydes' disappearance, and she probably decided to acquire their marriage certificate as a souvenir. Much like the Elizabeth Cutler situation, the problem with believing that Georgie White Clark and Bessie Hyde are the same person is that there's an actual historical paper trail for Georgie prior to 1928, disproving the notion that she had assumed a new identity. When you consider the fact that Georgie gave birth to a daughter in March of 1929, There's no way Bessie Hyde would have been white water rafting through the Grand Canyon without anyone noticing that she was 5 months pregnant. So while the idea of Elizabeth Cutler or Georgie White Clark being Bessie Hyde has been conclusively disproven, I guess it is still tempting to explore the possibility that Bessie really did hike out of the canyon of her own accord and started a new life somewhere. During their trip, Glenn and Bessie were photographed multiple times, and they were usually shown smiling, but a number of people have taken note of the fact that the final photo of the couple, taken by Adolph Gilbert Sutro, the last known person to have seen them alive, paints a much different picture. In this photo, Glenn and Bessie look pretty sullen, almost as if the rigors of their journey had completely sucked the life out of them. Since Bessie had expressed noticeable concern about embarking on the rest of the trip during her visit with Emery Kolb, perhaps there is some truth to the idea that she wanted to bring an end to this, and the only way to escape from Glenn was to kill him and leave the area on foot. But the problem with this theory is that all of the couple's supplies, including their food, winter clothing, and hiking boots, were left behind in the abandoned scow. Hiking out of that rugged Grand Canyon terrain in late November or early December is no picnic, so I think that if Bessie took off on her own, she would have at least taken some of these supplies along with her, because otherwise, there's no way she would have gotten out of there alive. No, it just seems likely that when the couple disappeared, they disappeared together. I know that over the years, Bessie's brother often liked to point the finger at her ex-husband, Earl Helmick. Since he was known for having a violent temper and had refused to grant Bessie a divorce, perhaps he tracked down the couple and murdered them in revenge. Earl wound up getting remarried in 1930, and whenever he was asked about Bessie, he refused to talk about her. However, there is no evidence at all that Earl was involved in Glenn and Bessie's disappearances, or that he even traveled to Grand Canyon National Park at all. Really, what are the odds that Earl, who lived in an entirely different state, would have been able to track down the couple to a remote area along the Colorado River? To put this into perspective, even though the Hyde's boat was spotted on the river from an airplane during the search efforts, it was 6 days before anyone made it to that location and found the boat. That should give you an idea of how inaccessible this jagged terrain was, so I'd say the odds of Glenn and Bessie running into anyone there, let alone Earl Helmick, who could have murdered them, are pretty much non-existent. The most logical explanation is that the Hydes drowned in the river and their bodies were simply never recovered. I guess one of the things that has given their disappearances an extra aura of mystery is the fact that their empty boat was found upright and completely intact, with no signs of any damage, so on the surface, it doesn't look like they could have gotten into any accidents which caused them to drown. After all, their supplies and possessions were still inside the scow, which would not have been the case if they tipped over. But let's not forget that earlier in the journey, the rough rapids had caused Bessie to fall out of the boat before Glenn was able to rescue her, and Glenn also apparently fell into the water on 2 separate occasions as well. So it's reasonable to assume that this could have happened again, only this time, they were not lucky enough to survive. There's also been this romanticized theory that Bessie fell into the water and Glenn heroically dived in to save her, but the two lovers wound up drowning together. According to Bessie's diary, the couple had made it as far as Diamond Creek Rapid, which was located at River Mile 225, and they were about to enter one of the most dangerous sections of the river. In particular, the 232-mile rapid, which has been nicknamed Killer Fang Falls. This is a spot where a pair of large jagged bedrocks, aka the fangs, protrude from underwater at the end of the rapid, and they can just sneak up on rafters, as there are numerous documented cases of boats being capsized or seriously damaged after crashing into them. Considering that Killer Fang Falls is only 5 miles away from the spot where the Hydes' empty scow was ultimately found, it seems like this is one of the most logical spots where they could have fallen into the water. Even though Glenn and Bessie were both considered to be excellent swimmers, this was a very rough section of the river. Let's also not forget that Glenn stubbornly refused to carry life jackets in the boat. If he and Bessie were wearing life jackets at that time, then this is a very survivable accident, but without them, they may not have made it out of the river alive. This also would have taken place at the start of December, so even if the couple made it to shore, the cold winter temperatures could have caused them to succumb to hypothermia or exposure. I previously mentioned that while writing Sunk Without a Sound, Brad Dimmick went all out for his research, going so far as to build an exact replica of the Hydes' wooden scow in order to recreate their journey along the Colorado River as closely as possible. After personally navigating the 232-mile rapid, Dimmick's conclusion was that Glenn and Bessie likely fell out of the boat and drowned there, while the empty scow continued to float downstream to where it was found at River Mile 237. It might seem odd that the scow could have potentially collided with the Fangs without sustaining any damage, but in the book, Dimmick recounts incidents from his trip down the river where his scow got involved in violent collisions which failed to leave noticeable damage. Now, I know Glenn and Bessie's bodies were never found, but the Grand Canyon is a large place. The search effort didn't launch until a week or so after the couple went missing, and there's no way to check every single inch of the Colorado River. But there are two little details in this story which could potentially shed some light on what might have happened to the couple. You might recall that when the Cold brothers found the scow, its bow line appeared to be fastened in a crevice in one of the rocks and caught on something underwater. Since the brothers were unable to dislodge it, they decided to cut the rope. While the Kolbs received some criticism for this decision, and later expressed regret about it, because some people believe that the other end of that bow line may have been attached to a body which had become stuck in some rocks underwater, which is why the boat had come to a halt at that particular spot. So by cutting the rope, the Kolbs had severed their best chance of possibly recovering Glenn or Bessie. The other interesting detail is the alleged sighting by the prospector of the brown leather jacket floating in the Colorado River. Now, this jacket was never recovered, and no one could confirm this sighting was 100% legitimate, but if the prospector was telling the truth, what if he did not just see a leather jacket, but rather a jacket being worn by someone whose body was floating face down in the river? After all, Bessie was known to have worn a leather jacket on this trip, so this sighting could very well be the closest anyone ever came to uncovering conclusive proof that the couple drowned. When you look at all the evidence, the only explanation which makes complete sense is that Glenn and Bessie both fell out of the scow and drowned, likely around the 232-mile rapid, and their bodies were simply not recovered. All the other twists and turns in this story, such as Emery Kolb's skeleton and the woman claiming to be Betsy Hyde, are nothing more than red herrings, though they have allowed the legend of the story to live on for nearly a century, and I'm sure their tale is still told around the campfire in the Grand Canyon to this day. Obviously, given all the time that has passed, the Hydes' disappearance is no longer being actively investigated by law enforcement, so I'm not going to advise you to contact the appropriate authorities in case you have any information. I think the only chance this case will have of ever being solved is if someone happens to stumble upon Glenn or Bessie's skeletal remains in the Colorado River somewhere, but at least with all the advances we've had with DNA technology, the remains could be positively identified should this occur. Overall, however, I think it's most likely this story is destined to remain an unsolved mystery. Anyway, another special thanks to our most recent Trail Went Cold voiceover contest winner, Colin Zavitz, for doing such a great job at narrating our intro. If you have already entered this contest before, you are automatically eligible for all of our future monthly random drawings, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter, and haven't already done so, please send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, listing the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. Once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've already produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and we've got a brand new bonus episode being released this month. And like I mentioned in the intro, we also recently implemented a new bonus reward for our patrons in tier 3, in which I recorded my own audio commentary track to be played over the very first Robert Stack-hosted episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which, of course, contained their segment about Glenn and Bessie Hyde. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Karen K., Thorne Adams, Megan C., Christine, and Katie W. Thank you all so much for your support. You may have heard that for the third consecutive year, I will be representing The Trail Went Cold by appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, being held at the Hilton Riverside Hotel in New Orleans from June 7th until the 9th. If you would like to purchase tickets to the event, but haven't already done so, we have our own personalized promo code you can use in order to get 10% off a standard badge. So to receive your 10% discount, please visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code COLD19. That's COLD19. In addition, I will also be appearing at another event, the True Crime Podcast Festival, being held at the Marriott Downtown Hotel in Chicago on July 13th. So to learn more information about this event and to purchase tickets, feel free to visit their website at tcpf2019.com. That's tcpf2019.com. Also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. Need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for another new episode of The Trail Went Cold.